And thanks, Dr. Middleton, for essentially talking through everything that I would have said in the first minute or the first point of my presentation. So I get to pass by all that because I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm just an idiot who read some books, and I'll just try to present what I have now. So by way of introduction, I don't have any notes, but I'll just have to look at me for the remainder of the talk. So I can remember vividly in my early undergrad holding hominid fossil bones in a physical anthropology lab, having a crisis of faith, freaking out, not knowing what to do, because this was tangible physical evidence that really challenged what I had been led to believe about origins and Genesis and creation. And that was my first foray into this whole world of evolution and creation. And it sparked, a decade now of wrestling with these issues. And I've really appreciated being part of the CSCA, hearing all of your lectures, and just being part of this world. I've really, really appreciated it. And it also led me to Regent College, where I just finished my Master's of Theology and wrote a thesis on original sin, which I think you have a little snippet of my abstract in your program, which of course I'm going to answer and address all of those issues that I outlined in there, or maybe scratch the surface and paint with a giant brush. Okay. How's that? Can you hear me now? Hot mic. Hey, how about that? Okay. So I was compelled to study original sin because it was one of the things that that I found was the reason that a lot of theologians and scholars, biblical scholars, were kind of tacking on a historical Adam and Eve at the end of the evolutionary process, which at the time I thought of just, it didn't make any sense to me because I had already kind of not dispelled them, but was still trying to wrestle with how they fit in. So, I mean, maybe you're like me and you're already reading Genesis as an ancient Near Eastern creation myth that is still teaching archetypal lessons for what it is, you know, means to be human. But like me, maybe you're equally confused as to how Adam and Eve and the origin of sin makes sense in an evolutionary creationist context. Especially when it seems like it's such an important part of the Christian tradition. So it led me to ask questions that I never really thought about asking, like, are Adam and Eve the reality of original sin, or are the origins and character of human alienation and evil something that can be grasped and expressed through a completely different conceptual framework? Can we talk about original sin without appeal to Adam's sin as a historical event? How do we understand original sin if Adam and Eve never actually existed as historical people? And how do we understand a fallen world if the fall never actually happened? That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but I'll try to answer all of those questions in 20 minutes. So I'm going to be talking about original sin, at least in two small facets of how we can think about the tradition of the doctrine and how we can think about a scientific understanding or expression of original sin. So one, I'm going to be analyzing Augustine's ancient biology and his understanding and interpretation of Genesis that influenced the formulation of the doctrine of original sin. And then I'm going to talk about the origin of sin in the context of evolutionary psychology. And talking about the emergence of morality. But first, I want to make the affirmation that that sin is true, sin is real, humanity is sinful, we're in need of reconciliation of broken relationship with God, and that Christ is the fulfillment of that reconciliation. I just think that this can be done without the need for Adam and Eve to be historical people and the fall to be a punctiliar historical event. So moving to Augustine, his ideas and the formulation of the doctrine didn't come fully formed by himself. He was influenced by a cultural context of the time when Christianity became the official religion in the Roman Empire. And Greek and Roman philosophy were kind of intertwining with theologies of the emerging church. And the doctrine of original sin emerged out of the necessity for Christians to understand far more than the meaning of the fall or an understanding of Genesis, but trying to understand a core principle of human nature. And Augustine was influenced by many of his other early church fathers, Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, who all had a wide variety of perspectives on original sin based on different interpretations of Genesis and Paul's writing in Romans. There was a really great plasticity to the idea of original sin prior to it being kind of solidified with Augustine. And I think there's something to be learned by that, in that this dialogue never really went away, even once it was solidified. But perhaps the biggest influence on Augustine was his kind of rivalry with Pelagius, who presented a much more humanistic perspective. One author described Pelagius as kind of the Tony Robbins of his day, being like, you can do it, guys. You can be like Christ. And it was very positive. It was very, but at the core was kind of humanist, whereas Augustine would combat that with a somewhat dour approach to human nature, that we were stuck kind of in, that we were wholly corrupt, that kind of idea. So I want to talk about Augustine's hermeneutics and his understanding of Genesis through his model of seed principles. He talks about God and reads Genesis in a way that I don't think anybody here reads Genesis the way that Augustine did. So he talked about God sowing seeds of creation. There's a two-phase kind of creation. He would form forming the world and then seeding it, planting it with seed principles, which were the invisible formative forces that animated the visible corporeal substance of organisms. So he first, well, I'll read from Augustine's The Literal Meaning of Genesis. He explains his view that for in the first creation of the world, God created all things simultaneously. He created man in the sense that he made the man who was to be. That is the causal principle, think seed principle of a man to be created, not in the actuality of a man already created, and then creating all things not together, but each in its own time. During the second phase of creation, God formed man from the slime of the earth and the woman from the bone taken out of man. So his two-phase creation has God sowing seeds of life, and it's his way of understanding, let the land produce. So it's almost a passive action of God in that second phase of creation, and Adam would have sprung from the earth, being a earthling. And he kind of has an interesting hybrid, because he wouldn't have said that God would have formed him with kind of human-like hands. He kind of scoffed at that idea and said, oh, God wouldn't do that. He would just have to speak it, and then Adam sprung forth, not fully formed, but grew into a man, and then was formed into fully human. So he's already playing with this hermeneutical hybrid of a lot of different perspectives at the time, and that his literal interpretation of Genesis is very different than what we would mean as literal now. So for Augustine, Adam was grown and developed and then formed by God, first planted as a seed and then shaped. So this, I have no problem calling Augustine's kind of ancient phenomenological biology. He would have infused original sin into that idea, encoded in seed principles. And it's echoed throughout his work. He continually makes reference to Paul's verse in Romans 5:12, which Dr. Middleton thankfully explained that was a kind of a misinterpretation, talking about how death comes to all through Adam, in whom all sinned. So for Augustine, all of humanity was subject to Adam's transgression because we were all literally in Adam's body, in his seed, as it will. as it may be. Sure. So Augustine's doctrine maintains the view that we inherit original sin through physical conception. And he considered the male seed the bearer of Adam's sin, because he thought human nature was transmitted through it in the sexual act. He described original sin in biological terms, like a wound or a contracted disease that is only transmitted through carnal generation. So these notions become problematic when we think of it as a conflation of spiritual reality with biological processes that don't really fit with today's understanding of modern biomedical science. For example, scientists today can fertilize a human egg with genetic material from any other cell in the body. In Augustine's view, or maybe an extrapolation of his view, this person would not have a sinful nature because the physical sexual act of the flesh has not taken place and there has been no male seed to carry on the curse of original sin. Another surprising feature I found in analyzing Augustine, surprisingly, was that the doctrine of original sin was not formulated in order to establish the correct understanding of human origins or the proper exegetical techniques for reading Genesis, but instead the liturgical practice of infant baptism evoked the initial speculation about original sin. Augustine calls the gift of baptism an antidote given us against original sin, so that what is contracted by birth is removed by new birth. Augustine emphasizes that infants are sinful from the moment of birth, which reveals his point of scientific concordism. So concordism is a hermeneutical technique that's helpful for biblical interpretation. It's asking two primary questions. What historical and scientific and theological questions are being asked in the Bible, are being shown in the Bible? What claims are being made in the Bible? And then two, are these claims, historical, scientific, and theological, corresponding to reality? So for Augustine, he presents an example of scientific concordism by blending metaphysical spiritual reality with biological processes. And as previously mentioned, modern biomedical science contradicts the concordism of his seed principles. It also challenges our understanding of original sin in infants. Medical technology has advanced to the point where we can keep prematurely born infants alive earlier than ever before. So the Christian response then has been to push the reality of original sin past infancy, back through the various stages of gestation, all the way to the zygote. So at this point, original sin overlaps with the topic of the origin of personhood. And that opens a whole new can of bioethical questions, which I'm not going to talk about here. But Augustine, again, would then, maybe twisting Augustine's words a little bit, he would be talking about baptizing the zygote, if that's the origin of sin at that point. But this point is that attempting to connect the spiritual and metaphysical reality of sin into a specific point of time, both historically and scientifically, is a fruitless endeavor. Original sin, in a non-concordist perspective, shifts away from an event model, like the moment of birth or the moment of the fall, towards a process model that acknowledges the reality that original sin was manifested mysteriously and gradually over a period of time. Evolutionary time, deep time, or childhood development time, that kind of idea of an age of innocence. So you can cast that idea of an age of innocence back into the evolutionary timeline that would be one of innocence, but also ignorance. So not, you know, tra-la-la, we're living in paradise along that time, but also not really knowing what we're doing and figuring it out as we go. So that, you know, is also called the evolution embryology analogy, if you've ever heard of that before. But speaking of evolution, yeah, let's get into it. So in the context of evolution, original sin then becomes part of a slowly emerging element of human nature, consciousness, conscience, and a complex system of morality. So I'm arguing that humans are inherently selfish, yet our natural selfishness is morally neutral and ultimately necessary for survival. And it is only with the advent of human conscience within a system of morality that selfish behavior can become understood as sinful. Simply put, we have to have evolved an understanding of right and wrong before we can have a conception of right and wrong before the face of God. But that's opening a whole line of questioning about whether we can be ignorant to our own sin and still be sinful, which I would happen to agree with. But I draw on a wonderful book by Christopher Boehm called The Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. And he argues that the development of human moral agency went hand in hand with the evolution of our thinking minds. So conscience evolved with consciousness. His hypothesis is that the precursor to morality was conscience, and that conscience evolution began as a response to systematic, but initially non-moralistic, social conditions. So he explains that all human groups establish some basic universal rules of conduct that frown upon and punish murder, abuse of authority, cheating, lying, theft, and socially disruptive sexual behavior. And it is these basic wrongdoings that can be cast back into evolutionary history. Boehm claims that these rules of conduct, quote, are so widespread that we may make an evolutionary assumption that as cultural practices, they would have been reasonably well suited to whatever social pressures were common in late Pleistocene human living situations. If you don't speak anthropologist, late Pleistocene era or epoch is 126,000 years ago to around 11,000 years ago. So right in that great leap forward zone. So in other words, as social systems evolved, so did the complexity of our conscience, and vice versa. We punished those who wronged individuals and the group as a whole. This created a social selective pressure and eventually influenced social behavior. So in this sense, biology and culture, nature and nurture, worked together to make us adaptively moral beings. So Boehm draws on the Genesis narrative and argues that our hominid ancestors used shame to draw a distinction between socially acceptable and reprehensible behaviors, and that humans continue to punish offenders with usually temporary excommunication from community in order to emphasize shame. Shame is a primary factor in the development of human conscience. And social ostracism is a powerful tool for instilling and developing our understanding of right and wrong. Think of it as if you wrong the tribe, you're kicked out. And at that time, being ostracized meant death. You couldn't survive on your own. So it had serious ramifications to go against the group. So that would have created pressure for people kind of sitting in the corner with a dunce cap and thinking about what they've done, to actually form and shape an internal sense of right and wrong. So, Boehm argues that once earlier humans began to strongly internalize group values so that they were beginning to be guided by an internalized sense of right and wrong, I think we might perceive them as moral beings. So this can be akin to Paul's natural law in Romans 2, the law that's written on our hearts, that kind of idea, retrojectively cast back into the evolutionary timeline. So through an evolutionary creationist lens, God used evolution to draw humanity forward into moral cognition, responsibility, and accountability. In this context, original sin is part of our inherent creaturely nature that craves the fulfillment of our selfish desires, even at the expense of others, and especially at the expense of our connection to God. Yet the recognition of wrongdoing is realized and learned in the same way that Adam and Eve's eyes were opened. So too were our ancient ancestors slowly recognizing the moral implications of their selfish actions. I'm going to talk about desire. Okay. So I'm talking about, for Augustine, desire is not morally neutral. Augustine, desire itself becomes sinful. In contrast, Patricia Williams, in her book Doing Without Adam and Eve, argues that our innate desires for temporal goods are a biological necessity and morally neutral. We are wired to acquire resources in order to survive and reproduce. Williams explains that while human sociality, kin selection, pair bonding, and child rearing are good and unite us in charity and fairness, the motivations are not completely pure, in that charity and fairness are partly driven by groupishness and egocentricity. Thus, the positive God-given desire to protect our children can drive us to sinful acts of revenge, blood feuds, dehumanization of the other, nepotism, racism, and genocide. Yet, without our egocentricity and nepotism, we would never survive and successfully rear our children. So in other words, humanity lives and has always lived with the tension of how to properly satisfy our natural desires for safety and security without falling into the trappings of sin. Jerry Korsmeyer, in the book called The Evolution of Eden, or sorry, Evolution and Eden, explains this tension, stating that we are drawn toward the good and unable to achieve it as we would. The unruly appetites keep pulling us toward the satisfaction of selfish interests. This tension echoes Paul's lament, "For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing." The struggle describes an innate pull towards sin that exists as part of our very evolved nature, without the need for Adam and Eve to introduce it through a single event. So by way of conclusion, I guess I want to talk about thinking of Genesis as this historical myth, etiological in nature, that it's describing how we are, how humans have always been, in relation to God, in relation to each other, in relation to creation. I like to read Genesis kind of through the eyes of a small Israelite boy, hearing his grandfather talk about the way things got to be the way they are. And so it's both etiological and teleological, because there's a sense of the way we are is the way we're going to be. But then you can read that through a Christological lens and the story changes. So it casts us back and calls us forward to a time of union and devotion to God. So the myth of Genesis resonates today, not because it is historically accurate, but because it is true. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Just all questions are related to Richard Middleton. Yeah. You can feel.
We will take a time for a few questions. And since we had a late start, at no fault to our speaker, we'll add 5 minutes on to our time and aim to finish at 12:35. So we'll have time for a couple of questions.
Sure. So, I think, there's a number of things that come to mind. One, I guess, is the developmental aspects of morality and evolutionary are all fine, but whenever I hear this, I don't think the conclusion that morality, and I'm not saying you're drawing it, but there are many people would draw the conclusion that morality has no transcendent character. It all is just stuff we invent evolutionarily. Sure. And my response to that is, what about math? We developed evolutionarily our ability to do mathematics, and it's far more sophisticated now than anything we ever need to survive. Does that mean math has no transcendent character or value, that mathematical theorems are not true in any abstract sense?
Well, they're not true in an evolutionary practical sense. I mean, you wouldn't need math to necessarily survive in the wild. But
the point I'm making is that the fact that there's an evolutionary development doesn't imply that what we do with that has no transcendent character.
I see what you mean.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I mean, I would think about the development of morality with, I wasn't able to touch on that element of God's involvement in the process. So if you're talking about it with transcendental or divine value, I could talk about God pulling humanity forward to be moral beings and having it be a guided principle, just without a specific punctiliar time event along the timeline. So having it be divinely guided, I'm happy to agree with that. I guess that doesn't really answer your question.
Divinely magnetized.
Right.
We're discovering something that's out there as opposed to just inventing something.
I'd say it's kind of a meet in the middle.
Yeah. Other question? I've learned to take the microphone away from my dear friend Robert Mann as soon as he asks a question. Are there other questions? Sorry, Robert. Well, in that case, we will move directly on to our next speaker.